The Wake Up Call with Richard Martin, Mondays and Fridays at 9 a.m. Eastern Time on the Progressive Radio Network.
Please be advised that the opinions and views expressed by Richard Martin of GF Investment Services, LLC, are entirely his own and do not necessarily represent the views of the company, its affiliates, or its officers. Investments based off of Richard Martin's comments are unsolicited by the company and are at the sole risk and prejudice of the listener and the investor.
Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. This is Richard Martin from Singapore on this 16th day of December 2011. All right, first of all, a little bit of housekeeping. I will be leaving shortly after the end of this session with you, and I will be back in the office on the 3rd of January. Now, I have told people that you will be able to contact me by email, not so much by phone, but I have recorded 5 shows for your every enjoyment and predilection over the holiday period, so I hope you will not miss a beat and listen in each and every week. They are longer programs, and they're the same length, 60 minutes, but I take certain issues and explore them in a little greater detail than is normally possible when I have live listenership on the air, because I'm always expecting calls and emails, and so I tend to keep things a bit shorter. This offers an opportunity to learn about a few things in a little detail. So don't fear, there will be entertainment for you all in an unbroken fashion until I get back on the 3rd. My next, of course, will be on Friday the 6th of January. Okay, well, I'm quite sure that my extremely illustrious listeners will not have forgotten the contemptuous way in which I greeted the absurd pronouncements right after Thanksgiving that sales were up 6 or even 16% over last year. I really do think I made my point at the time, namely that this was just rank lying to encourage people to shop even more and waste even more money on fripperies and other nonsense. Well, as of Wednesday, 2 days ago, we learned that all the breathless forecasts from EdenRF to ShopperTrack were just hot air and empty hype. Turns out that sales were indeed flat to up only modestly. Total U.S. retail sales in November gained only 0.2%, following a 0.6% in October. Even that month was revised downwards. Well, I can tell you, retailers themselves may pay the price for their massive discounting. Not only might their quarterly earnings be affected by the margin pressure, but they continually train shoppers to hunt for discounts. Retail therapy and sport shopping are being replaced by extreme couponing and sites like Living Social and Groupon. Quite frankly, we're left pondering what those people who were lining up late at night at Walmart and Best Buy for bargains were doing. No, it was not a sign of shopping enthusiasm. I'm afraid it was a sign of extreme economic distress. No one who can afford otherwise goes out Thanksgiving night to stand in the cold with a crowd to fight the stampeding, pepper-spraying mob for a discounted Xbox. As Barry Ritholtz says, here's your simple formula. Thanksgiving Thursday night shopping plus record food stamps equals bad economy. Well, the jobless claims are the major headline on CNN. quoting, unemployment claims at lowest level since 08. Supposedly, the number came in at 366,000, which is almost to the break-even point of 350,000. To which I can only point to the unadjusted data for the week, and I'll leave it to you to guess how much seasonal adjustment is required to make that number happen. The total number of people claiming benefits in all programs for the week ending November the 26th was 7,449,507, an increase of 874,670 from the previous week. They claim, however, that the advance number of initial claims fell by 95,506 for the past week. But the week prior, they rose by 151,000, which means that over the past 2 weeks, the unadjusted initial claims rose by more than 55,000. And yet the reported number has fallen by more than 30,000. Continuing claims in data for the December 3rd week rose 4,000 to 3.603 million, but the four-week average is down 5,000 to 3.666 million, which is another recovery best. The unemployment rate for insured workers is unchanged at 2.9%. Well, though shortened weeks and special factors during the holidays often cloud this report, the Labour Department cites no difficulties with the data. They point to a strong upward pivot underway in the jobs market and will build expectations for a strongly improved December employment report. Yep, it sure is hard to get right during the holiday season. And maybe it's also hard to get right during the election season, too. Just saying. Data, when not tampered with, tends to be consistent and without conflicting with other data. Yet yesterday, we got more conflicting data. A negative report on industrial production and a positive report for the New York Fed on manufacturing. This data used to be mostly consistent, but in the past year or so, it's become obviously far less consistent, and that tells me that it's not to be trusted. Again, no data from self-interested narcissists should ever be trusted. Ever. To wit, the Empire State Manufacturing Index supposedly rose from the flat level of 0.61 all the way to 9.53. And then you can contrast that supposed strength against overall industrial production, which fell from the prior 0.7% rise to minus 0.2%. So come on, one of the statistics is out of whack. Which one do you think it is? If I didn't know better, I would almost think we weren't really in the middle of another Great Depression. I don't know about you, but I'm frankly getting very tired of the lies, the spin, the outright fraud. I'm certainly glad to see the protester made it onto Time's Person of the Year. Maybe next year it'll be the revolutionary. The mask is now completely off Europe. Despite their meetings, rumors, and supposed deals to leverage to infinity and beyond, spreads continue to blow wide and politicians are forced to concede that solutions won't come easily. No kidding. That's because the impossible math and debt saturation they created just is. In the background, nations are making preparations for the day the euro in its present form is no longer. I actually believe we're quite close to that day. It is coming soon. There are dangers involved in the transition, of course, so we need to maintain our vigilance. Don't think the dollar and the U.S. are any better off. America's just better at charades for the time being. The dollar in its present form is equally toast. The clock is ticking here, too. Because that clock is based on the exponential math that underlies debt, time will appear to move more quickly into the future until we reach the event horizon. To me, that is the day the dollar in its present form is done. We wind up with the next iteration. The key will be who is then in charge of controlling the production of the money. That is the most important thing for every nation to get right. While the Europeans are having difficulty forcing more square debt into the round, debt-saturated black hole, criminals the world over are disappointed that the world's central bank criminals aren't producing massive more quantities of money. As if this were somehow not enough. All right, ladies and gentlemen, time for my information. Yes, this is Richard Martin of the Wake Up Call coming to you from Singapore. And if you would like to call in, the number is 888-874-4888. Again, 888-874-4888. Same as it was last year, and doubtless same as it will be next. And if you want to write in your emails, do please write in the same way as always to rm@gfawd.com. That's again, rm for Richard Martin at gfawd.com. And by the way, that reminds me, don't forget not to call in for the next five shows. Just do write the emails to me in the usual way. They just won't be dealt with until January. When I get back, I'll put them all together and we'll have an email blast somewhere at the beginning. So just emails, please, for the next few days. You can, of course, leave me a voicemail message if you want to, but better to email me if you have any any urgent questions or issues. However, for I won't bother with my personal number today. But I will bother with the January 29th Richard Martin meetup group, which will meet up on that day in New Brunswick, New Jersey. That's Sunday, January the 29th at 2 p.m. And it will be in the usual place, which has become the venue of choice, which is the Ale Street, George Street Ale House, 378 George Street. Please contact Susan, who will give you more details and also to register your desire to be present. And her phone number is 202-246-5131. Again, that's Susan at 202-246-5131. Just call her any time, let her know what's going on, and hopefully many of you will decide that it is worth your while to join up with other people of a like mind. Okay. All right, well, now we come to the entertainment portion of our show, which, as you know, is normally pretty turgid at this kind of time. And it contains yet another clip from our good friend Nigel Farage. Now, I think some of you, in fact, most of you probably have heard other clips that I've played on the show here. Nigel is, of course, the most outspoken, probably, politician ever of all time. And quite frankly, in this clip, which we're about to play to you, he absolutely outdoes himself. It's quite an extraordinary outburst. I don't know how many people among you would be brave enough to do what he did here, but I'm not sure that I would. Anyway, ladies and gentlemen, without further ado, let us listen to Nigel Farage at the European Parliament.
Colleague, co-president Nigel Farage, Freedom and Democracy.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. I've often asked myself the question, why would a successful country that's enjoyed 1,000 years of independence give up its right of self-government to the unelected non-entities that we see sitting before us this morning? And the answer that comes back from the Foreign Office and the great of the good is that we must have influence in Europe. We must have a seat at top table and we can change things. And we've done our best to prove what good Europeans we are. We go on paying you £50 million a day. We've helped the Euro bailout fund, even though we didn't join the currency, thank goodness. We've given you 80% of the fish stocks that swim in our waters. Your fleets can come and take that from us. And we've applied every directive you've given us absolutely to the letter, all of it to gain influence. In fact, Nick Clegg is so deluded, he still thinks we can take the lead in Europe. When a British Prime Minister goes to a summit with a very modest proposal to protect a uniquely important British industry, a snarling President Sarkozy tells him where to go, with German approval, of course, and we find ourselves without a friend in the room, some influence. Well, you've decided to head off on the Titanic towards economic and democratic disaster, and we're now in a lifeboat outside the Titanic, but we're threatened by a bow wave that is going to come and engulf us if we're not careful, and it's retribution. And we've heard the language of retribution this morning. Financial markets legislation is going to be imposed upon Britain, and we will have no influence whatsoever over any of it. Something changed, though, on Friday. Mr. Cameron may not know it, but we are now on course. Britain is going to make the great escape. We're going to get out of this union. We'll be the first European country to get our freedom back. I suspect many others will follow. And then what we'll have is our democracy back, our liberty back, and we'll have influence in the world as you lot head for disaster. It is going to happen.
Thank you. Mr. President Farage, blue card to you, yeah? Colleague Smith, blue card.
Thank you, Bardzo, Panchamni Chancellor. I'm grateful to the member for taking an intervention. Given that the actions, the very selfish actions of Prime Minister David Cameron in uniquely achieving nothing for the one square mile of the 86,000 square miles of the United Kingdom, has achieved nothing but actually undermined the 26 other member states trying to solve this crisis, would you agree with me that Prime Minister Cameron may well have made a couple of people in his party happy, may well have made a couple of people in your party happy, but given that he did not speak on behalf of the Labour Party, the Greens, the Liberals, well, not all of the Liberals anyway, he certainly did not speak on behalf of the people of Scotland, with one representative at the Westminster Parliament from my country. He certainly did not speak on behalf of the aspirations of the Scottish Parliament. Would he agree with me that if you do achieve your aim, which he has facilitated, that the United Kingdom does leave this place, that the people of Scotland would do considerably better representing ourselves, free from London rule, as part of this family of nations, as a constructive partner?
Could you ask to? Yes.
I have to say that's a very difficult question to answer because there were half a dozen of them thrown in there. But David Cameron did what he had to do. He was forced into an impossible position. But you're right. He's gained no concessions whatsoever, and he's actually left the United Kingdom now even more vulnerable than it was before. We're in a permanent voting minority. We simply haven't got a friend in the room, and we've heard this morning they want to have our rebates, they want financial markets legislation. But what he has done, he's opened up a debate in Britain. The European debate has now started in earnest. Cameron does not know what he's unleashed. I think the momentum for us to have a referendum to divorce ourselves from these failing structures and to replace it with a genuine free trade agreement now has an unstoppable momentum, and that is good for the UK, and it's good for Scotland, and it'll be good for your financial sector based in Edinburgh.
Thank you, colleague.
Provides many, many jobs for Scottish
people. Thank you very much. The next speaker, Madam.
Well, there you have it, ladies and gentlemen. I don't know if Congress will ever stoop to such depths, but I'm sure it would jolly the country along a bit faster if it did. But that would play havoc with the bribery and corruption crowd, wouldn't it? So I think we're going to have to put that one to bed. Anyway, as luck would have it, leafing back through material that I never got to, there was indeed an email from Steve Kruger pertaining to Nigel Farage, and I thought I should resurrect it and read it to you. Richard, I enjoyed the Monday wake-up call. I do so love to listen to Nigel Farage getting his point across in no uncertain terms. You don't have to fill in any blanks when he's finished speaking. He can be seen on YouTube, many clips, type in Nigel Farage and enjoy. Could you imagine if Ron Paul could muster up the fire and acidic delivery of Nigel Farage? I watched the CNN debate, and I have to say it looks like nothing more than an audition for the Gong Show. Herman Cain will not go much further as soon as people wisen up, but one of his nines is a new sales tax. Also, what scares me is the time he spent as a governor of the Federal Reserve, a subject he doesn't voluntarily talk about. I wouldn't expect him to change his stripes and dissolve the Fed. Unfortunately for us, the GOP will select the candidate whose turn it is, not who is best for America. That's how they run people like Bob Dole and John McCain, ancient politicians who are absolutely cadaverous, and we're stuck with them. The one with the answer to Americans' problems, of course, is Ron Paul, but I fear his fire has gone out. He is even more low-key than in 2008. Richard, I have to think he's been spoken to by the powers that be. I'm sure JFK was spoken to before he was taken out. I would think that they would remind him he has a son in the Senate. And of all things that can go wrong if he pursues his anti-Fed rhetoric, he has now come out with a pledge that if elected, he will cut $1 trillion in spending in his first term, no reference about the Federal Reserve. If things go as I suspect, that Mitt Romney will be chosen. After all, it is his turn. Thanks for the wake-up call. Steve Kruger. P.S. The letter from Patrick was great. He had a lot to say with many good points. Well, of course, that was written before Cain bowed out. So, quite frankly, I actually think that he's got some clairvoyance in him, as our Steve Kruger. Congratulations, and may you have a nice holiday too. All right, well, by the way, have you noticed how people like Bernanke always refer to citizens as consumers? It's taken for granted that all living adults exist to serve the needs of the business class. It's never even questioned or commented on. They might as well be referred to as spending addicts. It is implicit that consumerism is taken for granted, and in the background assumption that humans live solely to buy and sell more and more stuff is a systematic reliance on perpetual growth. Well, even if perpetual growth were possible, even if it were no trouble to grow and grow the human population and turn absolutely everything we do for each other into commercial transactions, and then grow yet further beyond that insane point, what on earth is the attraction of that kind of future? What is it about that vision that so appeals, that so bewitches us? Frankly, all I see is desperate and lonely addiction. And on the part of those appointed to protect the system as it is, the most terrible arrogance. Well. All right, let's take some emails. Let's go through some remaining emails of the year before we close up shop here. Adam from Chicago wrote in saying, Richard, thank you so much for your talks. They are like verboten fireside chats, and I eagerly look forward to them. I only found you a few months ago through similar channels of thinking, and I'm so grateful for your podcasts. Regarding your talk on December the 9th that discussed the trade deficit, I understand and intuitively agree with your concern that the U.S. is spending way more than it is earning from other countries. This certainly is a problem. But is it really? Here's why I ask. If we are moving towards a one-world government, then we must be moving towards a one-world currency. If that's the case, then money will be the same everywhere. If money is all the same everywhere, then what difference does it make if China is racking up more sales than the USA, Germany is doing better than Britain, or Brazil is beating Vietnam? If it's all one world, then the money ends up in the same place. Call it the central bank before it's divvied up. from each according to his ability, to each according to his need. Sure, there will be comparisons between and analysis of each Walmart store location to determine which stores can get new asphalt in the parking lots. But all the money goes to the Walmart Corporation, which makes the big decisions. In order to cover the opposite side of my previous question, in case I've erred in my premise, here's my next leap in thought. If the trade deficit really does matter, then that also means the currency really does matter. And if the currency really does matter, then that means that eventually, after all the dust has settled, there must be an adult way to determine what a currency is really worth. If this is the case, then we are moving past fiat currency to a currency based on some underpinning value. That value is either going to be based on something desirable and tangible, or upon the dividends that that nation's currency is capable of paying, which is based on what the citizens of that nation are capable of producing, basically the horsepower of that nation. That horsepower will be coaxed out of the citizenry by free market capitalism and entrepreneurialism, the carrot, or by slavery, the stick. We appear to be going the way of the stick. So, to reiterate my questions. One, why do trade deficits matter if the currency is the same everywhere and ends up in the same central bank? Two, if trade deficits and currency really do matter, will the underpinning of a nation's currency come from the hard assets or from labor? To boil it down even further, gold or slavery? I believe this is the fundamental question and is what we are all really talking about here. I look forward to hearing your thoughts. Adam from Chicago. Okay, Adam, well, some good meaty questions in there. First of all, I do disagree with your premise. Look, if the Europeans can't even agree on a uniform currency, the euro, how can we possibly be moving towards a one world currency? I mean, really, do you think that Germany is going to agree to use the same currency as Pakistan when they can't even agree that they want to be in cahoots with Greece? This is another of these crazy phenomena that are just bandied around by, you know, the second stream, if you like. I'm talking pretty much about things like zero hedge, which is useful and interesting and has some good stuff, but it's more and more fraught, it seems to me, with, you know, gross exaggerations and stuff like one world currency and a lot of energy given on stuff which is really not going to happen. So be careful. It's one thing that I told a listener earlier today in an email. Be very careful of these hyper blogs and websites that you are likely to come into contact with, which sound very seductive and interesting, but in fact a lot of them contain really impossible thought processes which you might want to avoid. And I really try to do so myself, even though I certainly don't belong to the mainstream, and I do like to think I hopefully do have an eye on the future here. So the money, therefore, isn't the same everywhere, and I don't think it's going to be so, Adam, which, of course, basically deals with the first half of your email. Now, the second question, if deficits in currency really do matter, then indeed the underpinnings of the nation's currency, which is where we really do want to focus on, come from, as you say, hard assets or a gold standard, really. That's the most obvious answer to the problem here, is a gold standard, which I do think will come back at some point. Not yet. It will be some years before we go down the slippery slope to reach rock bottom. But when we do, my feeling is that the gold standard will actually come back. It doesn't solve all the problems. Watch out. I mean, we had a Great Depression in the 1930s, and Most countries were on a gold standard, even though they might have abandoned it for a while, but the gold standard existed back in 1932-33 and didn't do much to solve the Great Depression. So don't think that all the problems of the world are solved by a gold standard, but certainly it solves the problem of Ben Bernanke and Alan Greenspan and their little games and experiments with our livelihoods. They won't have much to do. Slavery, I'm not quite sure where you come from in that one, Adam, but, I hope I've given justice to your question, and thank you very much for it. Very thoughtful. Okay, Zaid Hisham says, let me know if you find any listeners in Southern California who'd like to form a wake-up call. Call meetup group. There you go. Any listeners in Southern California, let me know by email, and I will inform Zaid and give him your email address or phone number. So if you are in Southern California and would like to help form a meetup group talking about the things that we talk about here, then please let me know, and there is somebody able and willing to moderate a group in Southern California, and that is Zaid. Okay, I got an email from Atkinson Lady, otherwise known as V, about Carl Deniger's piece about the safety of deposits. I don't think you need to worry about that, V. I think your deposits in the banks for the time being are safe. There's no indication that the FDIC is panicking or that they're not going to pay out on any banks which go under. Most of the banks which have gone under have had their assets taken over by other banks anyway. If we see things careening, out of control, I will be there for you. I'll give you some advice. All right, ladies and gentlemen, well, with that, I think we need to take a break. We will do, and I will be right back. Okay, we are back, and on with the emails. One from Kevin Moran, as follows. Mercosi goes against all of European history. Mercosi, by the way, is an amalgam of two presidents, the president of France, Nicolas Sarkozy, and the president of Germany, the Chancellor of Germany, rather, Angela Merkel, otherwise known as Merkozy. Okay, Merkozy. Merkozy goes against all of European history. I'll start in the 1870s, even though it goes back much further. The past Franco-Prussian War of the 1870s. Alsace and part of Lorraine, part of France, was taken by Prussia to become a part of Germany. World War I, where France lost a whole generation of men, which resulted in a destitute women 50, 60 years later in the 1950s and 60s, and beyond World War II, France occupied by Germany in a brutal way, 1940 to 1944. The future, France will allow itself to be dominated by Germany according to Mercosy watchers. Kevin Moran. Well, thank you very much, Kevin. Some pretty short, sharp, succinct history from you. Greg wrote in saying, being that we are deflationary environment and Fed has no intent to print more money, a hypothetical question. How big of a QE or a stimulus in billions or trillions would it take for the Fed or government to tip a scale and put us in an inflationary environment? Question is hypothetical since printing more money is unlikely. Your answer would enlighten us as to how powerful that deflationary force actually is. Regards, Greg. Well, Greg, you'd have to print pretty much at least $10 or $12 trillion. I don't think the print presses could print as fast as that. I mean, you'd have to print past all the debts before you come to get an inflationary environment out of it. I don't know what else to tell you. I mean, that's the problem that people, do-gooders, have when they talk about, basically talking about how bad things are and, and how much better they would be if people printed money. quite frankly, doesn't work that way. Defaults are defaults. You can't, cure sickness with more sickness, and you can't cure the origin of debt with more debt, and you can't throw money into a system unless it's debt-based, because that's what we live with. So it's a non-starter, it's checkmate, and it's not going to work. And it couldn't work. There is no amount of money that could be printed that could overcome the problems and turn them into non-problems. And of course, what everyone is waiting for when they're talking about printing is for the economy to turn round and sort of save us out by an overheating of the system, save us from our debts. And of course, so they won't admit this, but they really want to see hyperinflation, because they know that inflation would do what it did in Germany in the 1920s, which is to devalue the currency to the point at which your debts just didn't mean anything anymore in real terms. They would just be hyperinflated out of value. It's dishonest, and it's also a non-starter. And those people should be honest enough to step up and admit that that's what they want to do, in order for one to be able to tell them that it's just not going to work. But since they won't tell you that's what they're going to do, they conveniently avoid having to be criticized. Well, that's the way it goes. So, all right. We have a caller online called Johnny, would like to hear what you have to say, Johnny. Not too long, please, because please try to keep it as structured and focused as possible, because this is the last live program of the year, and we've got quite a lot of material to get through. So, having said that, Johnny, welcome to the show.
Hi, Richard. Thank you for the work that you do. You really educate me and a lot of other people. I want to keep my question concise as possible in the interest of time. My question is, with the meetup group that you have, one in New Jersey, and now there's a caller or emailer that want to open one in California, with the new law they just implemented in the Congress, 1867, which is law now, I'm wondering if they're not going to, come down on the meeting just to, caliber them as the new team that they have. That's my
question. I quite agree with you, Jordan, and I certainly believe that that's a very possible scenario, and it's a very prescient issue that you raised. And I believe that just yesterday, the president actually signed off on that bill. We all thought he was going to veto it, but he did not. He signed off on it. And it's a very great shock to me. I'm sure it's something that's going to be talked about a lot over the weekend. It's going to be a nightmare. I mean, we know how brutal these police can be. We know how extremely fascist can be the forces of law and order in different states. In fact, I did a whole program on America as a fascist state, which I believe you will be made party to on the 2nd of January. I think it's an interesting account of what's going to happen in America. Indeed, we are looking at a fascist state, which, with all that means. And that really does mean that when you step out of line, according to what the authorities have to say, it's a hop, skip, and a jump to being considered a terrorist. They use this term with gay abandon now. You're a terrorist. You're somebody against the system. You don't agree with the government. You don't agree with what's going on. It's absolutely terrifying. And I'm grateful to you for bringing my attention to this, Johnny, because what it really means is just yet one more a nail in the coffin of life in America. An absolute imperative that those people who possibly can, which is pretty much everybody, frankly, should consider emigrating to another country. And, you know, I don't want to hear stories about how it is not disloyal or anti-American or whatever. It is no such thing. It is simply doing what your predecessors did, the people that came before you from other countries to America. They came to America for the same reason that I'm suggesting that you leave America, because life became intolerable in their home countries. So So they hopped on a boat and came to America. Well, horrifyingly, though it may seem, it is now time to hop on another boat and go somewhere else. And this is going to become more and more clear to people in the coming months. And basically, I urge you all to consider it and to join up with the meetup group in New Brunswick, New Jersey, and as Johnny rightly says, in Southern California, if there is a group that starts up there, by all means, join that one too. I know Anne McKiffin in Texas would like to start up a group in Texas. It's all rather far distant and disjointed in geographical terms, but people need a venue for this kind of thing, and let's hope that we can provide something in New Jersey, if not in other countries. So again, Johnny, thank you very much for your call, and let's move on with a couple more emails. We have one from Greg, who... we had Greg's email already. I thought I recognized the writing. Mary Peer. Now, Mary is not Mary. I believe it's M-A-R-R-Y. It's a name I'm not familiar with, but Mary, for many thanks for writing in, and this is what Mary has to say. I am a fairly new listener to your radio show, The Wake Up Call. I was fairly surprised at your view regarding peak oil, namely that it does not exist. I went ahead and compiled some data and figures from three relevant sources into a short document which is attached as a PDF file. If you have the time, it would be nice for you to take a look. Well, I did. The data being presented is fairly clear, in that there is a higher probability for oil production rates to decrease than increase or even maintain their current level. Furthermore, the net energy being produced is likely to decrease further, which would ultimately translate into recession/depression as measured by real global GDP, as countries and corporations expend a larger share of revenues in maintaining and developing their oil-related energy infrastructure. Thanks, Mary Peer. Well, Mary, I think that there are certain problems with your premise. First of all, I don't think that oil production is going to decrease. As things are, if nothing improved, yes, of course it would decrease. But things won't be as they are. There are enormous areas of the world, tracts of land, which are producing more oil, new discoveries, new techniques are producing much more oil than most people think. As I've said before, I think peak oil is a form of conspiracy by the oil goons, trying to make you pay more for the oil they produce, to push the price up, etc., etc. They're really not winning that game right now. The price of oil fell $5 a barrel yesterday. $5. That's 5% of the value of oil was wiped out in one trading session. We're now trading at $94.38 in the March contract. Quite frankly, I see oil going way lower, probably somewhere between $20 and $30 a barrel, because despite what everybody says about peak oil, demand is falling quite sharply and will continue to fall as the depression takes hold, and there will be more oil brought onto the market in addition to the fall in demand. Supply will therefore grow, demand will decrease. That is a recipe for sharply lower prices. There you have it. I've given you my take. I've put myself out there for you, Mary, anything. So, yes, I think I've answered the question. Let's come to another email from Laurie Drager, who wrote in yesterday, I think, saying, as a rather recent listener to your informative program, I wrote to you once in the past asking about Mongolia, specifically investing in that country. I mentioned this only as a reference. My question today might be considered a personal one, and you may choose to decline to answer. I would understand. I am listening to Gary now dissect the Defense Authorization Bill, yesterday's program. As an American, I am extremely concerned about this bill. I've been concerned for many years, so much so that I will seek German citizenship once we leave China. My question is, does your wife have an American passport? Is she not concerned in spite of living in a foreign land? You urge your listeners to leave the country, as I have been urging my sister to do for 3 years now. But citizenship is a mighty consideration. Just wondering. All the best. Laurie Traeger. Well, Marlene, if you're listening to this and you want to come in here and have your say, you're very welcome to do so. In other words, how do you feel about living in a foreign country with an American passport? Are you concerned? If not, never mind. I will talk for you. I will give my opinion. As well, you probably haven't heard this yet because there's something of a delay on the... And I know you're listening because I can hear it vaguely coming next door. But anyway, come in if you feel like it and talk. Don't worry, ladies and gentlemen, about having an American passport if you live in a foreign country. It is not a problem. People have come to me with this issue before. You will find, even if you live in a foreign country, that when you present yourself at the American embassy once every 10 years, you will be received courteously by an American functionary and helped to renew your passport, and that will happen in any country. Nobody will refuse to honor your request. Nobody will turn you away. Your passport will be renewed. Never mind. If you want to live abroad, just be free. Feel free to go. Well, my wife has appeared here, and the question was whether you feel bad about living in a foreign country with an American passport, and are you fearful, you know, that they will take your passport away? Do you feel bad? Do you feel fearful? What do you think? Here she is, Marlene, my ever-loving wife.
Hi. Well, I don't feel I'm not worried about losing my passport. I haven't even thought about that, but. The longer I live here, and the longer I hear about what's going on in the States, the gladder I am to be gone. Because it's very, very sad for me, very sad indeed. But I'm very glad to be here in Singapore, and just I'm really glad we left. I hate to say it because I've been a true American for years, but I'm just. Horrified by what's going on there. So back to Richard.
Thank you very much, Marlene. Nice Christmas bonus for you all, ladies and gentlemen. Let's continue on. I hope I answered your question, Mary. Laurie, I think that should do it. For the emails, I thought I had one more, but I can't seem to find it. Oh, yes. Steve Kruger, another one. I received this message actually from Steve Kruger several days ago, but fortunately we have the time to get to it, so we shall do so. After a tumultuous August, pension funds for companies, governments, and unions are falling further underwater, raising pressure on boards to take on more risk at a time when the economic and policy outlook has never been more uncertain. Entering 2011, pension plans for companies in the S&P 500 were just 75% funded, down from 85% in 2010, and roughly 78% following the Lehman collapse, according to Goldman Sachs. Funding levels, likely even uglier on a municipal and union level, just got worse. And quoting Jim O'Neill, head of Goldman Sachs Asset Management, in a note to clients, the recent fall in equity prices and in interest rates has led to sharp declines in the funding position of many institutional investors. Recent market movements have left many institutional investors wary of taking risk, but at the same time mindful of the necessity of doing so in a thoughtful way. End of quote. after a volatile August that ultimately brought the S&P 500 into negative territory for the year, September kicked off with its worst three-day start post-World War II. Meanwhile, the 10-year Treasury yield is trading at a lowly 2%. Steve's response to it was, and I quote, "Looks like pension fund managers are being asked to go to the casino, at least a use for Greek bonds." Steve Kruger. Thank you very much, Steve. Well, Oklahoma rancher Ryan Payne checked on his livestock and found piles of entrails from two black Angus calves, he say thieves gutted, quote, like they were deer. They made off with the meat and another 400-pound calf in a heist he estimated cost him $1,800. High beef prices have made cattle attractive as a quick score for people struggling in the sluggish economy, and other livestock are being taken too. 6,000 lambs were stolen from a feedlot in Texas, and nearly 1,000 hogs have been stolen in recent weeks from farms in Iowa and Minnesota. The thefts add up to millions of dollars in losses for U.S. ranches. According to the American Kennel Club, the number of stolen dogs increased by almost 50% to 224 cases during the first 7 months of 2011, compared with the same period in 2010. Dog robbers play a waiting game for reward money, says Lisa Peterson, American Kennel Club spokeswoman. What happens is that criminals take a dog and then wait to see if a reward is offered, she said. And if it is, there's a phone call or the dog miraculously is returned for the money. A man wearing a mask entered a pharmacy in Bingham, Maine, with a sawed-off shotgun. He jumped over the counter, told Hibbert, three employees and a customer to get on the floor, and tied their hands. Then he left with the money and more than $12,000 worth of prescription drugs, including other narcotic painkillers. The latest holdup in Bingham was one of the most brazen yet in Maine. U.S. Drug Enforcement Administration agent Michael Wardrop told a group of southern Maine police chiefs last month. But, Wardrop said, it's clear that Maine's painkiller addiction is fueling much of the state's crime. It's out of control. It's rampant. It's our number one problem, he said. Identity theft is skyrocketing in southern Florida. In the first half of this year, the Federal Trade Commission received more than 20,000 complaints from Floridians whose identities had been stolen, nearly as many as in all of 2010. More than half those reporting their social security numbers or other personal information had been ripped off and used to commit fraud or theft were in South Florida, with heavy concentrations in parts of Fort Lauderdale, Hollywood, and Hallandale Beach. The FTC, which acts as a clearinghouse for consumer complaints nationwide, received more than 11,600 reports of tax or wage fraud in Florida in the first half of this year, compared to 4,524 for all of 2010. Medical identity theft is still a small percentage of the total amount of identity theft that occurs, but it's the fastest growing segment, said Jim Koenig, director and leader of professional services firm PwC and their identity theft practice. And finally, how about bridge theft? Oh yes, a steel bridge was stolen from a secluded area in Pennsylvania. The bridge had been in North Beaver Township since at least the early 1900s and was worth an estimated $100,000. So, ladies and gentlemen, any takers for a bridge? I didn't think so. Okay, well, that's the way the cookie crumbles, as they say. Well, the National Association of Realtors is admitting, by the way, that they too have been grossly overestimating sales after its numbers were challenged. The NAR took another look at the data and has decided to lower its numbers for home sales from 2007 to 2010. Last year saw the fewest number of homes sold in 13 years. Now we find the number is even smaller than the 4.91 million sales we thought occurred. The National Association of Realtors, which for decades has published statistics on sales of existing homes, said that its data were wrong and that fewer homes were sold from 2010 to 2010 than it had reported. New numbers will be issued on December the 21st, the Associated Press reported. Questions about the numbers were first raised earlier this year by CoreLogic, a real estate analysis firm, which said that NAR's home sale numbers could be as much as 20% too high. While the NAR said 4.9 million existing homes were sold in 2010, CoreLogic said its analysis showed that only 3.3 million homes were sold. The NAR responded by saying it would take another look at the data. In recent months, the group consulted with CoreLogic, as well as the Federal Reserve, the Department of Housing, Urban Development, the Mortgage Bankers Association, the National Association of Home Builders, Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, the AP reported. The NAR concluded that its numbers were too high, and that some sales had been counted twice. Oops! Reported home sales 20% too high? Just a mistake. No nefarious action there? No. No self-interest-driven deception foisted upon the masses that a commoner might commonly refer to as fraud? No, says President Obama. Technically, they can't be prosecuted because they didn't break the law. Really? Guess he's never heard that. Fraud is completely illegal. Well, ladies and gentlemen, I'd like to finish my last live talk to you of this terrible year with a quote from the Old Testament, which is considered a holy book by Jews, Christians, and Muslims alike. Here's Ecclesiastes chapter 1, verses 9 to 18. What has been will be again. What has been done will be done again. There is nothing new under the sun. Is there anything of which one can say, look, this is something new? It was here already, long ago. It was here before our time. There is no remembrance of men of old, and even those who are yet to come will not be remembered by those who follow. I, the teacher, was king over Israel in Jerusalem. I devoted myself to study and to explore the wisdom, all that is done under the heaven. What a heavy burden God has laid on men. I have seen all the things that are done under the sun. All of them are meaningless. A chasing after the wind. What is twisted cannot be straightened. What is lacking cannot be counted. I thought to myself, look, I have grown and increased in wisdom more than anyone who has ruled over Jerusalem before me. I have experienced much of wisdom and knowledge. Then I applied myself to the understanding of wisdom and also of madness and folly. But I learned that this too is a chasing after the wind. For with much wisdom comes much sorrow. The more knowledge, the more grief. So, ladies and gentlemen, let me wish you all a very, very happy Christmas and a very successful and prosperous New Year. And may 2012 bring you and yours as much happiness as you may desire. Take care of yourselves. See you all on the 6th of January. Bye-bye.